CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 135 with Dr. John Ferris, an incredible teacher who's going to show us the most effective ways to teach surgery to the next generation.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest, someone who I've known for many years, who is a true expert in teaching the next generation, the young generation of surgeons who are going to make us pseudophagic one day. And that is Professor John Ferris. Welcome to our podcast.
Uday, it's nice to have an upgrade right at the start of the podcast. Plain mister, not the academic echelons of a chair, but thank you anyway. Lovely to be on the podcast. Great to see you.
Well, thank you. And obviously, we have a big task ahead of us. We have to train the next generation. And I think, I look back and I think, it's so much harder now, and there's so much more material now than there was a generation ago when we trained.
Yeah, it's harder, but it's safer. And as you know, we caught up at ESCRS in Copenhagen, and for three of those 4 days, I, along with 30 other colleagues, were teaching from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock at night. We put 220 European trainees through the ESCRS simulation lab. So we'd 8 ICs, 8 stations for model eyes, and just giving the Europeans a flavor of what US residents and UK residents kind of take for granted, which is the facility to practice their surgery, develop their skills away from patients, and then go on safely to transition to live surgery. And I've been doing it for 10 years in Europe, and it's still sadly predictable when these residents come through. They've completed their 3-year residency, and I would say 90% have had absolutely no surgery at all.
Wow, that's like a...
literally nothing.
Yeah, there are countries where the norm is to not do surgery, and you have to do some sort of apprenticeship later and learn on your own.
Exactly, which is shocking in many ways. But in the US system, the UK system, and in fairness, some European systems, there are safe surgical protocols in shape. But the first battle, really a decade ago, maybe a bit longer, was trying to convince people that simulation was actually necessary, because you're very much confronted, well, in my day, we didn't have simulation. In your day, you didn't record your complications, or you've the selective memory of what a good trainee you were. When we look back honestly at where we were, as from a patient's perspective, which should be of our primary, focus, patient safety, it wasn't a very safe way of training. You can see one, do one, teach one. Hopefully now it has been consigned to the dustbin of history. And trainees, and a lot of it thanks to you, Dave, with the videos on the Cataract Coach, they're so used to watching the videos, practicing that maneuver on the simulator before then trying it on the patient. So it is ingrained in many of them, and in institutions as well. And it's now, as it's in the US and the UK, there is a very straightforward pathway to starting surgery. You must have done the IC courseware A and B. You must have completed a mandatory 2-day course at the college or another accredited centers. And then you're straight into your surgery, learning your surgery, having learned the basic skills to make you safe in the eye. And that's the problem European surgeons have, is they may go in these courses, but there's no, well, what next? As Sarah Malling said to me in Copenhagen, well, what next for these people? What's next in the US is you're sitting beside Tom Oating in Iowa, and the team there, or a similar, program, and somebody is taking you through the next steps of live surgery.
Right. Throughout your residency, you will have a consultant or attending level physician sitting right next to you for every single case.
Yeah.
And there's a big, obviously great learning there, but also great comfort.
No, absolutely. And what the simulation has done, it's made it more comfortable for the attending as well. Because as the last thing that we used to teach was capsulorhexis. Because if they made a mess of the capsulorhexis, no matter how good a surgeon you are, it's going to be tricky to do a safe phaco. And now they're so good at doing the capsulorhexis because of the IC training and model eyes, they really find that pretty straightforward. So it has become less stressful for you as a trainer, for them as a trainee. And we've proven with the big study that we published in the BJO that simulation reduces complications. There's RCT level evidence for that in glaucoma surgery, small incision cataract surgery. So for the doubting Thomases, if there are any out there, which I don't think there are, but it does work, and that ultimately saves money. It reduces litigation, reduces complications, and of course it's much better for patients.
Yeah, very true. You know, I got to tell the young ophthalmologist, you're not joking when you said the old dogma was see one, do one, teach one. That literally, that phrase was said to me throughout medical school and even beginning of residency. That literally was the dogma.
I mean, I'm old enough now, and I'm a bit older than you, that we started with, you know, extra cap. I did the good extra. I mean, the beauty of phaco is it's actually quite an easy operation compared to doing a good extra cap. You've got somebody with beautiful hands, a lovely section, five beautiful corneal sutures, zero astigmatism. That's really hard to do. And yes, it is a safer operation, phaco, but when you were training, that was quite a hard thing to learn. Ended up eyes that started to look a bit like what the US would say, a football, you know, NFL, you know, shape ball with like six diopter cils. You don't get that anymore. Or strabismus surgery, often though the first year resident was, given the squint to do, as if that was an easy option. Completely different set of skills again. So it is changing. And it also is giving people the opportunity to show that actually they have the skills to learn and adapt. So if they are in a system where there aren't many surgical opportunities and every healthcare system is pushed, public healthcare system, pushed for time and money. So if you're going to take half an hour, 40 minutes to do a phaco, and you've got the experienced scrub nurses sitting there tapping their fingers going, come on. There's all sorts of, you know, pressures. And if you practice with your simulation, then you're going to be faster, you're going to get more surgery, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you become more confident, and so it goes on.
Yeah, you know, thinking back when you mentioned the ICE, we were one of the first programs in the U.S. at UCLA, my former program where I used to teach hands-on, to get the ICE, and we actually had to publish some papers just to show, like, no, here, data will show that it actually makes them, the residents, better surgeons to go through the program.
So the paper that I first presented at the fantastic, the AUPO meeting, which for any educationalist listening, I really recommend it as a fantastic meeting to go to. We presented it in 2018-19. So we had 263 residents in 29 hospitals, first and second years, completing just over 17,800 operations, each of which is recorded electronically in the Royal College of Ophthalmologists national database, case mix adjusted. And it showed here were the complication rates, PC rupture before introduction of IC and after, fell from 4.3 to 2.6%, 38% reduction in PC rupture rate with the induction of IC training. And that, when you look at the cost of litigation, and Larry Benjamin and Brian Little done some nice work that's looking at the average cost of a PC rupture in the NHS. So cost and equipment, return to theatre, cystoid macular edema, litigation. It's about £4,000, about $5,000. So if you can reduce the PC rupture rate, 450 cases a year, that's a lot of money. That buys you a lot of simulators.
Yeah, exactly. It does.
Yeah. So the evidence is there that it works. And the work done by Will Dean in Africa, looking at glaucoma surgery, trabeculectomy, particularly topical in the US. There's that great editorial in Ophthalmology Glaucoma by I think it was Mark Sherwood and Kuldeep Singh, saying trabeculectomy must survive, because with all the MIGs and all these sort of fancy but perhaps less effective operations for proper glaucoma, there are states in the US where trabeculectomy isn't carried out, North Dakota and a few others. So if that dies out, then when people have serious glaucoma and need a proper operation, you know, they do have, and simulation is great for that. The retinal buckling, you know, still a small proportion of retinal detachments require a retinal buckling procedure, not a vitrectomy. And again, simulation is great for building up people's suturing skills. Because with phaco, we don't suture anything. Extra cap days, we were great with 10-0 nylon. And I was busy quoting you in Copenhagen Uday, you've got 10 and 10, 10 corneal sutures in 10 minutes with the knots nicely buried. So when you've done that, then you know you're on top of your suturing. Another reason, you know, simulation is so effective because nobody gets to stitch anything. If you've got a suprachoroidal hemorrhage, you need to put a nylon in quickly. If you're fumbling around, that's not going to be a good outcome.
Well, I found that the residents who did that 10 sutures of pentonylon 10 minutes in the wet lab actually had great ability to control their hand under a microscope. So even if they're doing a different maneuver, let's say like the phaco or phaco chop or making a capsulorhexis, which is not suturing, but the fact that they can use their hand so effectively under the microscope.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a strabismus surgeon, so those that know me know that I'm sort of do cataract surgery, but a lot of pediatric ophthalmology and strabismus. We get a resident maybe come to us second, third year, done 200, 300 phacos, great phaco surgeon, give him a bit of 6-0 Vicryl on a nose that gets in the way and an eyebrow and a deep set medial rectus, you know, whole different skill set, which of course, if you're doing some general ophthalmology, you're doing on call, you know, you get ocular trauma coming in, you've got to have those suturing skills and handling the soft tissue and things like that.
Right, even for the trauma cases, we had cases where that scleral laceration goes under the muscle. You may have to disinsert
the muscle off.
Early.
Absolutely. Right. So when people say, well, yeah, I'm going to be a corneal surgeon, why do I need to learn strabismus surgery in the residency? And for that very reason, well, if you're dealing with ocular trauma, you've got a globe rupture, blunt trauma, you're going to open up the conge and tenons and find it goes under the medial rectus, you're going to take it off, suture it up, put it back on. Absolutely right with you. And I think that needs to be emphasized to people who don't necessarily understand why it's helpful to have that in your armamentarium.
So your recommendation now for a young resident or registrar who's just learning is, as you said, do the IC courses, do the 2-day course at the Royal College, and then do you start with like little procedures?
Still the same the way, and again depends, every surgeon will have a slightly different way, but it's usually still reverse chaining, as Larry Benjamin would say, maybe just removing a bit of viscoelastic at the end. We also, it's mandatory, they must have watched your residence videos for residents, so they're watching live surgery first. And also, for those, again, your listeners who are not aware of it, that fantastic free iBook by Paul Sullivan, Larry Benjamin, and Brian Little. And as you know, the last two gentlemen were the sort of doyens of surgical videos, 20 years ago. And we'll come on to that a bit in a minute. But it's a free iBook, beautifully animated, lovely videos on every step of phaco emulsification, including the topics you mention a lot on your cataract coach videos, the sort of phaco dynamics and how to set up machine, because trainees need to understand why the settings are different for sculpting and chopping, all that. So they get to, and if you're not a Mac, an iOS, a Mac user, iPhone or iPad, you can get the PDF. It's all for free. It's called Phaco Emulsification Surgery by Paul Sullivan. And it's a free resource and it's great. And that gives you the background, because on the courses, you don't want to be talking about the theory and, chatting. What they want to do, they're there to do hands-on simulation practice. So we've trimmed it from a 3-day course to a 2-day course because they've done all the learning beforehand. They've watched your videos, they've gone through the book, they've done the IC practice, they're ready to go. But once you get to theater, it's similar, your steps, I would imagine. I know, because I've had the privilege of teaching with Tom and watching him again on your fourth podcast, talking about his work with Orbis. So we did a trip to Trujillo in northern Peru together and to Santiago. And as you correctly said in the podcast, one of the top, not just in the US, but the world's top cataract surgery trainers. And we train in a similar way to Iowa, where you're doing different steps multiple times.
Right.
I think Tom would say, open the theater, there's maybe a 4 theater complex, and the trainees is going and doing capsulorhexis in each theater to build that confidence. And because they're out there, capsulorhexis skills are good. They're doing that quite early on. And the new version of the IC software has come up. So in the top right hand corner, and I'll say, well, I've absolutely no interest whatsoever in Hagstrite or the IC. I just think it's a great bit of kit. But the top right-hand corner, they've got a cross-sectional video as you're scooping, because, all they see from above is this. Right. And they don't realize the lens is that shape, and they go through the back. They can actually see in the corner of their eye, actually, if you're sculpting that way, you're going to go through the back of the capsule. So building up those three-dimensional constructs in your head is really helpful. But we're lucky because in the US and the UK, they are going to go to theaters where they're given the opportunity with cases which are appropriate for their level of training.
Yeah, I think that's a key point too, is getting an appropriate case, not giving the small pupil pseudoexfoliation dense cataract to the newbie, to the resident just starting off, for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I love your idea about backing in the procedure, because if you start the procedure with a terrible incision and terrible rexus, the whole procedure is a mess.
Yeah.
But if you just back in, let's say you have someone with green hands who's just learning, and okay, the case is basically done, the eye was in the bag, here, just aspirate out the viscoelastic from the eye, seal the incision, put a spinal nylon suture in, now you're done.
Yeah, absolutely. Because their confidence, it's very easy to destroy a trainee's confidence if they go too quickly, and they try complex, and they have a problem or a complication, it sets them back. Even the most robust trainees, they are sort of set back by that. So you want to just nurture them through those first 50 cases so they're building up their confidence. Well, I can do this. I can translate my IC skills and model eye skills into a human being. And watching your videos is key. At our podcast recently, we spoke to Arthur Cummings. And I know you've interviewed Arthur in the podcast, but he had an 8-year gap where he was doing no cataract surgery when he moved from Pretoria to Ireland, just doing LASIK and things. And the question I asked him, well, what was it like? I mean, he'd done literally thousands of phacos going back to surgery after an 8-year gap. He said, it was terrifying. Right. I said, well, what did you do? He said, I came across the video series of Larry Benjamin and Brian Little, and I watched those videos day and night. He said, I was like a gymnast standing on the side of the floor mat or on the beam, and I was just going through things mentally, every tumble, every turn, and just thinking about each step and refreshing myself. So when I went back to surgery, again on private patients, high expectations, I had those videos just whirring around in my head, and the day before is your website. But I would imagine there's thousands of trainees around the world, who have your voice in their head, when they're doing it, and comforting to know, well, this is what I should be doing. And I found myself parroting you basically for 3 days a day. We were teaching corneal incisions and capsular rexus, and I see myself draw the circle. Right. And this concept of drawing the circle, and as they're always pulling in towards the center because they're scared it's going to tear us. Look, Uday will say, I want you to do a capsular rexus without even looking where it's tearing. I just want you to pretend the tip of your capsular rexus forceps is a felt tip pen and draw a circle. And by the end of the morning or the session, they were drawing a circle because I didn't even look at where it was tearing. So I'm not suggesting you do this in a real patient, but on simulation, just to show the vectors, if you keep on doing this, it seems counterintuitive, but it will form the perfect 5.5 millimeter capsular rexus. And so many commenters, that was so helpful. Even those trainees who'd done quite a lot of surgery, there was the odd one like that. Oh yeah, I've got to totally change this. I'm always pulling towards the center.
Right. And then you end up with the baby rexus, which
the baby rexus,
the baby rexus.
Curse. Yeah.
The baby rexus. If you do a 4 millimeter rexus, your surgery is going to suffer. You're going to suffer.
Yeah. Or just simple things. Again, in your videos, you've emphasized when you're sizing the rexus, yes, if you don't have your forceps marked like you have, if you're doing it 1 millimeter from the edge of the pupil every time, 80% of the cases, that's fine. Small pupil, massive myo, you're going to end up with a rexus way too big or way too small. So it was a really rewarding session. I've just put in a nice collage of pictures together of them holding the iPad with a picture of their first rexus. I'll send it to you after the thing. Yeah, there'll be about 8 of them.
Beautiful.
20 of them all just saying proudly. It's almost like the first baby. Look, here we go. Look at this. My first rexus. Look how round it is. You can't even tell where I started and finished it. I don't know who came up with that idea.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I always say your signature on the eye is that rexus and the incision. Because even long after the inflammation is resolved, the corneal edema is gone, you will always see that rexus and the incision.
Yeah. And they knew that, and they were again parroting you, because every single one without exception and they knew about the website, you know, and was watching it. So it's a very powerful and simple message. And same with your tips on primary chop, stop and chop. You know, that's going right in their head. They're kind of rehearsing it the night before.
It's a new world. I have to be thankful to people like Bobby Osher, who, you know, a generation ago was truly the godfather of ophthalmic surgical video. I used to go borrow his VHS tapes from any attending who had them. Let me please borrow those tapes. I'd go home and study them in low definition, no less. So he's clearly the godfather. But I think ophthalmology so lends itself to learning from a video. We have brief surgeries. It's easy to incorporate the recording system into our microscope.
Yeah.
And people like me with a short attention span, you know, if I put a 5-minute video up, I can watch 5 minutes. An hour video, I may get bored.
And the other thing that you've emphasized, and knew that our mutual friend Sunil Mamtora will emphasize, and that one of the video competition that he won with you was actually you being your own, you know, harshest critic. So encouraging the trainee, record every surgery, watch every surgery back, you know, maybe with a friend, you know, a couple of mates get together. Here's my videos for the last week, and do it together in a friendly way and say, well, that Rex is a bit off center. And you just refine it, but you've got to look back at the videos. You've got to watch the videos again to do that. And if you record every case, so if there is a complication, you can say, well, how did I manage that PC rupture? How was that anterior vitrectomy? Mm-hmm. Could I have done it better? And being honest with yourself, because that's how athletes improve. You know,
right?
Yeah, that's how musicians improve. You know, right. And when it comes to simulation, people say, "Well, you know, I just get all my practice in the operating theater." Rory McIlroy just doesn't go and hit golf balls, you know, in a competition. He's out there every day trying to get better. You know, especially the Ryder Cup just around the corner. You know, all these people. You know, four tennis players play a match; they knock up. They warm up, and there's something that surgeons, I don't know, maybe we're just too arrogant to think that we can't improve. And again, another lovely phrase from Arthur Cummings, I can't remember who he was quoting, a colleague who'd said, if I've been away from work for a week on holiday, I can tell the difference. If I've been away for 2 weeks, the scrub team can tell the difference. If I've been away for 3 weeks, the patient can tell the difference.
Interesting. Yeah, I see that.
And I think what COVID is, I mean, two advantages of two sort of slight silver linings to the whole, you know, COVID pandemic. One is that it made people realize that a break from surgery is a stressful thing to come back from. So parents, mainly women, but you know, guys who've had, you know, time off and maybe, you know, hadn't the easiest reintroduction to things, maybe not the most sympathetic bosses saying, come on, just, I know it's been a year, but you know, you've done it before, crack on. Suddenly these same people, mainly men, 3 months out of surgery, were coming to me saying, you know that simulator thing you've got? You know what the code is to get into the ICU? Right? Sure. You know, I'd quite like to have a little go. So, and that was only three months away. And the other thing that it's really helped with, of course, is virtual training. Still the most popular video on our simulated ocular surgery website was your virtual teaching you did from your office in LA. You were at home. We had 4 UK trainees at home with the STEMI microscopes, and you were giving them live in time teaching, doing capsular access. So a simple microscope linked to their phone, linked to Zoom. And that's been used by Orbis and a lot of teaching they do, other people who are. So you can have a mentor anywhere in the world for these, you know, large parts of cataract surgery. And you do not have to travel. You don't have to go to the expense of being there. Orbis and Hunter Cherwick and the team have done this, mentoring people who've been on a course, getting into live surgery. So the world's a smaller place and people kind of access to great teachers. As Will Dean said, it's democratizing access to cataract surgery, making it available to everybody potentially.
These days, there are no secrets anymore. That's the beauty of this. It used to be, a generation ago, well, where did you train? You trained at that institute? Oh, you probably learned a lot of really good stuff. Well, I tell you, everything's out there now. Everything.
Yeah. And the other thing the trainees don't appreciate is that once you become an attending or in the UK, you know, a consultant, you don't get to see your friends operate. It's not like a trainee where you're in together, you're mixing, you're seeing lots of different people. You're maybe going, you know, in a US program, you know, 12 different people have taught you different bits of cataract surgery. Right. Suddenly you're out in practice, maybe in the US, or maybe doing some, you don't get to see people. The only way you're getting to see stuff, and it's fantastic, you go on your website, you've got, you know, literally thousands of videos to look at and different techniques. And I think one of the phrases you'd said, if you're still doing your phaco the same way as you were doing it 10 years ago, you know, you're probably not doing a great service to your patient, because you could be learning new things and subtle changes in technique. So it's great when trainees come to me having worked with somebody else, and they go, "Oh, that's interesting. Who taught you that? Oh, okay." And you're always picking things up, always learning.
Yeah, I mean, even now, I learn much more than I contribute. I mean, it's amazing the stuff that's out there. In fact, I'll even do things like I'll be at a meeting, I'll see a great lecture, a really brilliant technique, and I'll approach the speaker afterwards. I need that video for Cataract Coach. We got to tell the world about this. We got to get it out there.
Yeah. And you had such an array of contributors, and the lovely ones also from the resident, you know, second year resident, first year resident. And so I think they're really encouraged. They see things like that. And like a lot of surgical videos, you learn from not people's mistakes, but just things that could be done better. You get them to reflect, you know, on what they've done, the positioning of the lens, or their chopping technique, or not quite deep enough there, didn't quite get. But, and right. they're learning from watching that. But I think the next stage. The next step, though, is to say to people, you know, the simulator is not just for people starting, because we're still a million miles away from pilots. You know, the most experienced BA pilot, you know, are doing 18 hours of simulation every year. And they get on the simulator, they don't know if it's going to be a bird strike, an engine failure, or whatever. And they've got to deal with it. And because surgery is becoming so safe now, the PC rupture, the National Ophthalmology Database in the UK, showed that since we started recording complications, which again are case mix adjusted, so you can see where you are relative to the case mix you're operating on, has fallen from about 1.5% to close to 1 or under 1% for UK consultants.
Well, that's actually spectacular.
No, it's very good. But the problem, if you like, Uday, is that people aren't getting practice, good for patients, but not getting practice doing anterior vitrectomy. Mm. There's a lovely study done by Laura Orban in St. Thomas's about 6 years ago, sixth and seventh year UK residents, all have done maybe between 500 and 700 phacos, and they'd done on average 3 or 4 anterior vitrectomies. Only 1/3 of those people, about to become consultants, felt they were confident and managed a PC rupture from start to finish. So initial management, vitrectomy, clearing up, choosing the correct sulcus strength, you know, lens. You've got loads of videos on that on the Cataract Coach, talking to the patient afterwards, dealing with it. So they've done huge volumes of surgery, but the complication rates are so low. And I think we should be looking at ways of making sure everybody's doing cataract surgery. And some insurance companies are rumbling about this in the UK, maybe demonstrating your competence to deal with the complication. I don't know what your feelings are.
It's hard to become good at it. Yeah, it's hard to become good at doing anterior vitrectomy when you don't do it too often.
When you exactly, and that's again the new iterations of the IC, which most people in the US and certainly in the UK will have access to, will put you through your paces there. And again, it's going through all the little steps in your own mind. Yeah. Don't take the instruments out of the eye. Keep it in. Keep the infusion going. Disperse the viscoelastic. Start at the base. You know, get rid of the traction, sweeping, all that stuff. But if you're not doing it very often, it's stressful.
Right. Yeah, I think it's helpful also to watch these videos. I had two videos this past week, both involving basically vitreous loss and capsular issues. And the nice part was, like, I'd say, look at the beginning. This right here is when you should have first noticed something. Yeah. And then you can watch the video.
People snap.
Yeah, you can slow motion it. You can just, so I think there's a lot of learning there too. I'm super lucky that I basically taught all residents that used to lay their first few cataracts for 22 years. So I used to deal with a tremendous number of broken capsules because they all happen essentially as me being the consultant with them. So they put the phaco probe through the capsule. Okay, let's fix them now.
And the senior trainees in the UK used to hover around the theatres where the first and second years were operating. Hopefully they slip in and just help out with doing an anterior vitrectomy. Right. Much less stressful for you to deal with it if you haven't caused the complication. Which is a mindset thing. Wasn't my mistake that led to this. I'm going to come in and calmly talk about it. Again, it can be simulated really well with the model eyes, with egg white and triamcinolone substitute. But the other thing to simulate is, what are you going to say to the patient? Because if you're very calm and your nurses, it's like the Formula One pit stop team, they know exactly what they do. They can change the wheels in, you know, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, because you've got the scrub nurse who goes, right, okay, I'm going to set up the anterior retractor. Somebody else is David Lockington, and you heard David on the podcast, the fire drill. He'll have a little pack with all you'll need, some triamcinolone, some tenno nylon, some little chart with you choosing what lens. If everybody's very calm, you know exactly what to do, there's no blind panic. And Larry Benjamin talks about his dinner party voice. He would say, sister, please could you pass me the anterior retractor? Thank you so much. Could you pass me the salt and pepper? It's all very calm. There's no fluster. Right. And the patient afterwards, you know, you talk to him and say, look, this is going to take a bit longer. This is the issue we've encountered. It's all going well. Let me know if you're uncomfortable. And they come away having not had a traumatic experience. You can end up with the most technically brilliant result, but if there's been a bit of panic and shouting and go, I don't know where this is, and, you know, where's the Myocol, whatever, then the patient's going to come out thinking, God, they really didn't know what they were doing. Whereas if it's all calm, and because patients do listen to what we're saying, then they come out and goes, well, I was aware that could be a problem, you know, because in the pre-op consent, I'm aware of that. Yes, sorry that it's happened, but it sounds like it's been dealt with. Well, you're much less likely to be sued if they didn't have a traumatic experience in theatre. So technical's one bit, but it's what's going on here. Your team all around you knowing what they're doing, that's what really is the determinant of a successful result. You can be the best surgeon in the world, but if you don't have everybody else just calmly going about doing what they're doing, then the patient's going to think, that was a hell of a mess in there. And if you don't end up with a good result, you're going to be hearing from them.
Yeah, that's a great point. You actually made a really important point that I want to reemphasize, which is, you said, if it's not your complication, it's a lot easier to deal with in a calm and collected manner. So one of my pearls for resin was, all right, you just had a complication. Let's say the capsule is interrupted. Step one, let's keep the infusion on. Let's get our dispersive viscoelastic, inject it through the paresthesia, stabilize the eye. Now you stabilize the anterior segment, you come out of the eye, stop. Let's take a breath, exactly. And now, let's imagine this patient was referred to you right now to fix this issue, this complication. Now, what's the best way to proceed? And if you take that one step back and you look at it like, okay, the patient was sent to me to fix this issue, how should we do it? You do a much better job.
Yeah,
really do.
And in the US, they're doing great work. The SCORE team, you know, Shazad Mayan and Grace Soon, Tom Petty, all these guys, you know, put together a really lovely curriculum for advanced surgical skills. I was asked to contribute to the anterior vitrectomy one. And it's that pause, you know, to stop. The eye's now safe, instruments out, pause, gather your thoughts, and then go. I think it's really good. And, you know, breathe. And breathe. Because again, Sunil presented a really nice paper a couple of years ago looking at the IOL implant, sulcus IOLs in our region, Bristol Eye Hospital, our hospitals, about 250 cases of PC rupture. The correct IOL was only put in about 30% of cases, 40% of cases. Wow. Well, sometimes the correct IOL went in, but they've gone about calculating the wrong way. And you could argue about if you do capture, optic capture, you know, what you choose, but they hadn't, you know, taken into account the different A constant, the position, and all those things. So if you're flustered, it's very easy to end up making people, compounding the problem by making it a bit myopic or a bit hypermetropic, when if you've been calm and paused, and maybe the biometry isn't to hand, you know what? On scrub, yeah, go and have a look, do the calculations, come back, scrub up again, and do it. And that can be, that's simulated scenario where you could put people in that stressful situation. I think it's a really good thing to do. You don't even need any model eyes. A PC rupture, there's the biometry. What are you going to choose? What's the lens?
Right. No, for sure. for sure, to put yourself through the paces, make sure, you know, you kind of know what you're doing there. And the other thing that I always would tell the resident, okay, you've had this complication. It's going to be a longer procedure now. Give more anesthesia. Don't do the full vitrectomy under topical anesthesia. This patient deserves more anesthesia.
Yeah, yeah.
Systemic as well, if you need to.
Yeah, no.
So.
And it's what people worry about, I would imagine, in the US when they go into independent practice. Because what, average is 250 cases, 200, 250 in residency?
Yeah, probably less than, yeah, somewhere in that range, probably low 200s.
Yeah, you know, and they've maybe done one or two anterior vitrectomies. Right. And for those, when you eventually go out into practice, there's nobody beside you. You're it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why those courses are very popular at the academy meetings and elsewhere, because the chances of having to carry out that maneuver in residency is very much reduced because of simulation.
It's been a world difference here. Mm-hmm. Absolute world. Yeah, and we no longer. I was one of the residents where we had to do 10 old fashioned extracapsular surgeries with the corneal scleral scissors, which arguably, as you said, is a tougher procedure. We had to do that before going to phaco. Now we don't. Residents, obviously, for the last many, many years, yeah, start with only phaco. But then the catch is sometimes they'll finish their residency training not knowing how to do MSICS, which I think is supplanted ECCE.
Yeah.
But just, you've got to learn how to do that. I would tell them, make a list of things you must learn in your residency. And if the onus is on you to make sure you get that experience.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a philosophy we follow in our teaching in the UK, is you're fortunate you've got access to all this simulation material, you've got access to practicing facilities. It's entirely up to you how much you want, you make use of it. But unless you can say the strabismus surgery, you can show me you're competent to do a nice safe scleral suture, secure a muscle, you know, on the model I, before you start with me, you can spend 6 months with me and get no surgery because I won't let you operate. Now, that's never happened, but you know, but those people like Rebecca Jones and others, you know, who really put the effort in, they come in on day one having spent the preceding month practicing, because they're coming to a strabismus firm, already up and ready to go. And we presented a nice paper, APOS, in New York a couple of years ago, to show you do not actually need anybody to teach you the basics of strabismus surgery. So we took 8 first-year residents who'd never seen a strabismus operation, and a little ping-pong model eye with some foam. They watched the videos on the simulated ocular surgery website, and we said, well, once you've watched it once, just scleral pass, nice, safe scleral suture, because with the scleral sutures, you know, you just press on the scleral, let the spatulate and needle do the rest. You don't do a dip like with the corneal suture, and how to secure a muscle. So we want you to record with your phone your first attempt. And you have the scoring matrix, and they're all scoring, you know, 1 or 2 out of 10 in a scoring matrix. Now, for the next week, watch those videos and practice until you think you've got it really nailed, and record your best one at the end. And they're all scoring 7 or 8 out of 10 with competency. And that's with nobody teaching them anything. So one of the barriers to simulation training is attendings. And I say, oh, I don't have the time, I'm busy, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But if you can give them access to videos and to practice, and they can record themselves practicing. It only takes you 5 minutes to look at them. Yeah, that's good. No, hold the needle, hold it in a different way. You know, that pass was a bit deep. And 2 or 3 minutes of your time gives them the tips to carry on the practicing. So we showed that even when they had a 15-minute virtual session with me one-to-one, I didn't really improve what they were doing very much at all. They had taught themselves by watching the videos, reflecting, and doing again, just to get to the stage where they're safe to start placing scleral sutures and putting a suture in the eye.
That's fantastic.
Because time's the problem for the trainers. You know, busy attendings, busy programs.
But you know, what's interesting is that we teach ourselves now the entirety of our careers. So 5-6 years ago, I wanted to learn DMEC. Well, I watched a lot of videos. I called some colleagues. I said, "Give me some pointers." And I didn't just watch videos. I studied them like over and over and over again. And then you basically have to teach yourself. If I think back when I did my training, or you did your training, these things didn't exist. There was no femtosec and lasers. There was no, like, we had, like, I didn't have any trifocal lenses. In fact, I didn't have toric lenses. Certainly didn't have femtosec and lasers. I didn't have phaco chop. There was no anti-VEGF. There was no OCT machine.
No.
So it's just
like, and when you think back, you know, how did we diagnose cystoid macular edema? You kind of, you know, looked at, you got your 90D. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, so technology has really equalized the playing field. So in the old days, if you look back to Don Gass's Macula Atlas, what an incredible retina specialist he was. Because the pictures he drew before the advent of OCT look like OCT images.
Yeah.
My gosh. So he clearly had the ability to see this. But now with an OCT image, even a dumbo like me, I can just look at the OCT image and say, there you go. But if I look at the slit lamp, you know, with a 78 diopter lens of that macula, I don't know if I'll see that.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And you look at, you know, Gass's papers when fluorescein angiography came out in the early 70s. It was a whole journal, wasn't it? It was all full of his papers from Bask and Palmer, you know, how they came up with that. So it has changed completely how we, and even the cataract surgeons, it's nice to be able to look at the news. So, well, looking at the OCT beforehand, picking up your early epiretinal membrane, pigment epithelial detachments, the importance of the tear film, we're much more clued up about that as ophthalmologists, you know, now. A lot of, you know, talk, every refractive meeting, quite rightly, you go to is, you know, this is the first refractive surface of the eye. If you want nice, accurate biometry, you get all the fancy lenses in the world. If you don't have accurate biometry, if you haven't treated their dry eye disease, and some amazing kit now for looking at meibomian gland function, tear film breakup time, all of these things need to be addressed if you're going to have good results.
Right. I mean, for sure, here in Los Angeles, boy, dry eye disease is a big deal. We're such a dry place. Like today, it'll be, I know it's already September, but it'll be 30 degrees Celsius today. It's going to have, it'll be 10% humidity.
Yeah. But it's also our lifestyle, you know, screen time. We know your blink rates reduce massively. If you're stuck in front of a screen all day with your work or leisure, this is a multifactorial things as well as humidity and climate that's going to add to that. But I think there's a growing awareness of how important that is, especially when it comes to different types of lenses and which ones you might choose for your patients.
Absolutely. So I think young residents today, young radiologists, just be prepared. You need to keep teaching yourself the entirety of your career.
Yeah, because when you started, you were probably like me, but it would have been divide and conquer, you know.
Yes.
I would imagine that's what you were worse.
I had a faculty member said, no, you got to bowl it out. Only bowl it out. One-handed phaco, only just bowl it out. I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah. So the other interesting thing I've been lucky enough to be involved with is teaching in Cape Town with an amazing team there, supported by ESCRS. But they had an IC put into a Groote Schuur hospital, the hospital where they did the first ever heart transplant, Christian Barnard in the 60s. Very famous, very beautiful hospital underneath Table Mountain. And we go twice a year and we train experienced small incision cataract surgeons. So these people have done, some of them, thousands of small incision cataract surgery. Of course, the perfect operation for dense cataracts, much better than a phaco. They'll do 40 in the morning, just lovely scleral tunnels. But burgeoning middle class, but also people with, you know, 618, 624 cortical cataracts, where that's not going to work. So you're teaching these people how to do a capsular excis. And they do a tin opener capsulotomy normally, and you show them your videos, and they go on the IC and the model eye, and within literally 2 minutes, what like that? And you go, just like that, actually. The phaco, it takes a little bit, you know, the depth, but it's amazing what it's like teaching people who've already been inside an eye for hundreds of hours, you know, doing that, and just the subtle changes in their technique. But again, they're going back to work in a hospital with a dodgy phaco machine, not like our beautifully maintained anterior chambers of the latest, you know, Bausch and Lomb Alcon machine. Remember back in the day when you started, that PC was,
you know, bouncing.
Post-occlusion surge. And our trainees now say, what's post-occlusion surge? Well, it's this historical thing we used to have to deal with, because when you went through the capsule, there was about a second or two delay before the vacuum stopped and the PC would come up. So they're going back dealing with that without any proper viscoelastics, but it's a really great project and helping them transition from small incision cataract surgery to phaco. And the technology, I think, has made a big difference, hasn't it? Because now, again, I'm much more relaxed training, knowing that the phaco machine is going to compensate for maybe trainees who go through the back of the last piece of the nucleus. It's not going to suck up the capsule from behind.
Right. I've been using this new phaco machine, this new toy, where it even has temperature sensors. So if the phaco tip gets too hot, it'll limit the energy to avoid a phaco wound burn. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
This is that, you that, bless these engineers. These engineers have made our lives so much better. Yeah.
Is that the Unity?
Yeah, for sure. And so it's I don't have any financial interest with Alcon.
Yeah, I know you don't. I know, but I saw they went through it the standard ESCRS. I went to see the Alcon. It does look a really nice bit of kit, and again, reduce phaco energy. The temperature bit was really interesting, wasn't it?
It's really neat. The new technology we have, and gosh, what about even the future? I mean, I'm working with a robotic surgical company now that I do have a financial interest in, Horizon Surgical, by the way. But wow, what's coming in the future is unbelievable.
Yeah,
I mean, this will make the rest of us as good as the best of us. I mean, this is unbelievable technology. It will save you every time. So I think that's
It'd be nice to think that. Yeah.
But as you said, some of these places where you're teaching in Cape Town, I mean, it's hard to ask them to buy a machine that costs that much.
Yeah.
Right. These are super expensive technologies.
Yeah. So the way it works is that, so we were teaching trainees who come from Tanzania, from Nigeria, anywhere in sub-Saharan Africa, they would come. And Alcon have got a good setup in Joburg. They're doing the same thing. Orbis, a lot of work again with. And a lot of people think Orbis is all about the plane. And as Tom said on his podcast with you, the plane is really a simulation center. And yes, some live surgeries are done, but it's mainly to show how to anesthetize a child properly or other things. But they work in partnership with people on the ground who have facilities for ongoing teaching and training. And yeah, the IC is an expensive bit of kit, but there's funding for these trainees to come from all over sub-Saharan Africa to spend time down there. And the point with these people is they're already quite skilled intraocular surgeons, so they have to spend proportionately less time on the IC to pick up. Once you just things like irrigation aspiration by manual, how to go in and come in and suck like this, and within a few minutes they're just getting it.
Right.
They're used to using a Simcoe, and sucking out, and this is how to the foot pedal. So they have to spend much less time on it to develop their phaco skills. It's the first time I've taught people who are already very skilled in their own right with a different type of cataract surgery. And Cape Town in November and March, not a bad place to go, David, to get you over there. Kindly sent us a video. You sent us a video for our first ever course, which we played to the assembled trainees. You go, wow, Uday Gavan's talking to us.
I've been to Cape Town for beautiful. In fact, I'll be in South Africa at the next South African cataract meeting in February. That's going to be in Joburg.
Very good. Yeah. Well, I think, Joburg, nice, but, Cape Town, another city, Yeah.
I enjoyed it very much. Cape Town, the Bayfront, the Stellenbosch region. I mean, wow, that is a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, well, I hope that you shipped, suitable volumes back to the the Devgan seller.
Fantastic. But I think you're right. Teaching someone who already has good interocular skills is a lot easier than teaching someone, again, who's first-year resident, first-year registrar. Okay, you've never basically touched an eye. Let's start from step one.
Yeah. So Uday, question for you. We started a podcast a year ago called Eyes and Tomorrow. And the concept is that myself, being an ophthalmologist, have hooked up with a very good friend, Dermot Keogh, who is an optometrist. Now, he's from Southern Ireland. I'm from Northern Ireland. You think, historically, there have been difficult relations between those two parts of the same Ireland, but we're great mates. We come at things that's from slightly different perspectives professionally. And it's been a fantastic way of listening to what optometry are up to, what ophthalmology, and great guests like Arthur Cummings, Keith Barton, Paul Foster. And it's kind of right. People said it's like desert island discs for ophthalmologists. It's sort of like what you do. You want to hear a bit about the person themselves and what they've done. But what was striking, you may have found out with all the people you've spoken to, is, and it's helpful getting us over to trainees, these amazing people, often started off in a completely different track. right. where they've ended up. So Keith Barton, one of the world's top glaucoma surgeons, he did a Corneal Fellowship in Bascom-Palmer,
mm-hmm.
and wound up being Arthur Cummings was going to be a urologist. Andrew Dick is amazing, a uveitis specialist, going to be a rheumatologist. And quite often there's just little forks in the road that they went on and just changed the path and had the bravery really to change track and to do something different. So a lot of trainees sort of worry about what should I be doing next and should I have the next 10 years planned out. What would your advice be to them when it comes to their careers? I know it's slightly different in the US, the structure of what to do after residency, but what would be your pearls for them to say UK trainees? Because if you look back at your career, there's no way you would have, I would imagine, thought this is where I'm going to be doing all these other things. Yeah, the day job, that's what I thought it was going to be. But all the other multifaceted areas of your career have happened because you've taken opportunities and run with them.
Yeah, I think I have never been good at predicting the future. I think none of us can. So when you worry about what you're going to do in 10 years, you're needlessly worrying. You need to not worry about that. And I think focus on what you're doing now and then look at opportunities. And if you decide you want to pursue an opportunity, just do it. And then I also have no regrets of whatever I did in the past. And in the US, for sure, majority of people who finish the training and take a job, that first job is like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They're nice and all, but may not be the one you're with forever.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's okay. Life goes on. Yeah. So find your best fit. And then I also just thought it was a great idea. Every 10 years, maybe switch gears a little bit. So I taught resin for 20 years, 22 years. That's enough. I need to pass this on to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has stronger coronary arteries, so maybe it's only in the 30s.
Yeah, there is that.
Let's pass this on. But then let me look at other opportunities. And sometimes you don't know what's going to hit.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're going to really love. And then finally, ultimately, you want to find what you would absolutely love. So for the first 6 years of my practice, when I was, 30 to 36, let's say, I did everything. I thought my training was so good where I did residency that I did basic eyelid surgery, strabismus surgery, glaucoma mm-hmm. surgery, cornea surgery, cataract surgery. I didn't do parts of a tracheal sclerobronchus, but I did all the diabetic lasers. I was happy with everything, intravitreal injections. And then finally, okay, that's nice and all, but I actually only really like cataract and refractive. And even among that, my practice is 90% cataract, 10% refractive, or you say keratorefractive.
Interesting.
Because I like cataract much more. My family asked me, aren't you bored of making those dumb cataract videos every year? I love cataracts. I'm not
That's the thing, but people who are not ophthalmologists who do it, They don't realize that they don't get bored doing cataract. Everyone's different. Every single one is different. And if you're looking at the bread and butter, when I'm talking to third year medical students, because they come through my clinic and they're young and often quite naive, and if they haven't come from a medical background, they don't really know about the different specialties and family medicine, all the other different options. I said, well, it's really important to choose something you're going to be happy doing with the rest of your life. So how am I going to know? Well, speak to the junior residents, senior residents, younger attendings, in their 30s, speak to people in their 40s, and speak to somebody in their 60s. And if you come across a specialty where people in all those age groups are still happy and still like going to work, then there must be something, there in that group. Because it's very easy to be seduced by maybe amazing time in the ER, seeing all this really cool stuff. But you think, you want to be doing that when you're 45, on call? Maybe you do, great, but think about it. And one of the problems that our UK trainees have when they go out socially is when they speak to their non-ophthalmological mates, they've stopped being asked, how are you getting on? Because they're kind of sick. And people say, oh, it's great, I'm doing this operation, doing that, really loving it. Going, don't want to know. Bloody ophthalmologist, really happy, smug, not getting out of your bed at night, the rest of it. But it's important to look at the whole package and go into a career or a subspecialty for that matter, knowing what's life going to be like?
Right.
What's going to still keep your interest going. And that's why if you've got an educational bit or business element to things, you're involved in management or leadership roles, all those can be complementary to your clinical work, which is your core work. But I think you need to have other things. If you were just doing the day job you were trained to do in 20, 30 years, you might get a bit stale. But if you've got lots of other things and surrounded by young trainees or interesting projects or work abroad, it does keep young. People say, well, why do ophthalmologists keep on working into their 60s and 70s? I think because they enjoy it.
Because it's not work.
But it's a hobby we get paid for. Aren't we lucky?
Right.
How cool is that?
No, I think. Listen, I'm thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist. I mean, what a blessing this has been. But again, it's not for everyone. But if you're in ophthalmology, you're looking about what's my first job going to be, just go into it, open mind, open arms, make of it what you can. If it's the right fit for you after a while, stick with it. If it's not, okay to change gears. And then I always encourage, pursue some sort of side project that you like. Maybe you like to do some research, and I'm not good at bench research. Maybe you like to make videos. I like that idea. Maybe you like to travel and teach hands-on surgery. Do that. Maybe you have an invention you wanted to pursue. Definitely do something else.
Yeah. And we spoke in Copenhagen about another aspect of things I've been involved with. It's recruitment. It's actually selecting the next generation of ophthalmologists to get onto the training program. So I had the pleasure of working at the Royal College on the training committee for a decade as I was head of program in this part of the Southwest. Sure. And I was involved in changing the way we recruit ophthalmologists. I know we spoke a bit about this in the past, the sort of UK system, which is one set of national interviews where we were all doing exactly what was happening in the US 10 years ago. Every deanery, in which there were about 17 programs, if you like, had the same had separate interviews, and every trainee would traipse around, travel around the UK, not as onerous as traveling around the US, but still travel nonetheless, and go to multiple interviews, and then you weren't quite sure if they'd accepted your job. Were they still going to accept it when they'd been to the Moorfields interview or the Oxford interview? And we just decided that actually we're all asking the same questions. Why not just do it in one center with representatives from each training program there, with carefully collated questions for probably about 3/4 of the trainees who applied. They went through a sort of a pre-test to get them there. And in 2 days, you interviewed everybody, and they had a score from the 4 interview stations they went to separately on the day, and their CV, their portfolio. And it seems to work really well in improving access to training programs for ethnic minorities, for women. And the quality of trainees is still fantastic. And the other thing is that the trainees choose where they go. We don't choose where they go. So they will rank the training programs. And if you're highly ranked in your group of trainees, you're more likely to get your first or second choice. So the vast majority of trainees who come to us in August, we've never met before, never set eyes on them.
Well, that's interesting. But
we've got the confidence to know that because of the selection procedure they've been through, they're going to be good.
For sure.
And that's quite a leap of faith. And it took a bit of persuading. There were 3 of us on the committee set up by the college to go to our colleagues. But once they'd been involved with the interview process, saw how it worked, they could see how fair it was and how it was good for trainees. And of course, the cost savings are huge. One set of interviews, and I know we spoke, it's done online, well, even cheaper, online and fairer. And you end up still with great trainees coming through, but it does require a bit of a leap of faith to think, well, I didn't actually see them beforehand. And I know there's multiple reasons why that might not work in the US, but in other people involved with training programs and listening all around the world to the podcast, might be something to think about, because I think we could still be doing better at making it fairer how people can get a foothold in our great specialty.
Yeah, it's I like the approach, because in the US the onerous part is that there's so many residency programs, let's say 120 plus, and you have so many applicants who apply to like more than 100 programs.
Yeah.
So let's say for for a program offering 8 positions per year, you make it 500 or more applications.
Yeah, that's a lot of time to shortlist. Yeah, it takes a lot of time.
Right. It's really difficult. And then now, fortunately, a lot of the interviews are done online.
Yeah.
But in the past, before COVID, you had to fly across the country. You could say, okay, maybe at most I could interview at a dozen programs, 15 programs.
Yeah.
And then you'd be on planes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge cost because you're flying from the West Coast to the East Coast to, you know, to Florida, to Washington State. You're crisscrossing the whole country.
It's not very green, is it? A bit of a carbon footprint there. Not to mention the expense for trainees to do that. It's they're already coming up with all the student debt in the UK and more in the US. And a lot of the time, we're not really sort of mindful of that. You know, the cost of doing the UK exams. I think it might have been David Lockington again, the paper, how much it costs for a UK trainee to go through paper courses, do the exams. But it's $3,000 or $4,000 it would cost to, even if you passed every exam of our three sets of exams first time around, four sets of exams, and been on the course, it's expensive business.
Right. Well, even afterwards now, even when you're in practice now, right? Every major society wants, let's say, $800 or $1,000 a year to be a member of it, to register for the meeting, the same thing, $800 or $1,000. To write the fancy letters after your name, okay, that's more. You want to be board certified. The board certification company wants money every single year the rest of your life. Like, wait a minute. But I guess such is life. But I think that's a nice opportunity to have all the people getting interviewed basically at the same time. It makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, and pre-COVID, when it was face to face, the trainers loved it because one time, apart from maybe a meeting, but you'd 100 mates who were there, all get together and A, you felt you were doing something worthwhile, but B, in the evenings, chatting to them. It was a really great networking. It was the closest we could get to AUPO, where everybody who's interested in education is there. And they all have a say in the questions, and they'd look at them and make sure they were happy with what we were doing. I think it's been a really positive step to get good people coming through the program. The problem is we're getting more and more people. The genie is out of the bottle. People in medical school realize how satisfying ophthalmology is, so more and more people applying. I think we'll have over 2,000 people maybe applying this year, certainly pushing.
Wow.
For 80.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
So it's that when National Recruiters started with maybe 400, also, 500.
That's 4%.
Yeah, it's
2,000 down to 80 is 4, what, right? 2,000 down to 100 is 5, that's 4%.
Yeah.
Wow.
So a lot of disappointed people out there who don't get on first time round, but many of them will apply again and get through.
Exactly. If I had to apply right now to ophthalmology all over again,
you always say that. Thank goodness.
I'd be a GP, man. I'd be a straight up general practitioner. I'd be just doing aspirin band-aids. That's all I'd be
absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely. No. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just unbelievably competitive. Now, I'll tell you, I'd love to hear what the interview questions are, because I only had two interview questions that I really want to know for any academic. They're all smart. They've all done great research. They'll all be fine. My only two questions were, number one, what was the last thing you taught yourself outside of medicine? And it can be anything. So, I learned to pick up a guitar. I've been watching these YouTube videos about how to pick, or I'm trying to learn Spanish as a second language. Love it. Because you got to be able to teach yourself the rest of your career. So show me you can do that. My second question was, describe me what you think your perfect day of residency would be like. You're a senior resident, and you come home one day and say, wow, that was an amazing day. Describe me that day. Well, you better describe our program, because it's literally all I've got to offer you.
Yeah.
So those are my only two questions.
So we have actors who are trained to play the role of patients. So.
Okay.
And so it's communication skills. And we're trying to say, well, would you want this person to be with you in the clinic? So the first year, so you are in the ER. You're not an ophthalmologist. You can't ask them ophthalmological questions. But you're on the staff. You've got a 50-year-old woman with headaches. And it's quite obviously a raised intracranial pressure headache, the way we've described it. And she's starting to be sick, and she's getting visual obscurations. And you've looked at the back of her eyes and they look like this, and you show them they've a picture of barn door papilledema, can't be anything else. And by the way, her father died of a brain tumor. So the actors we've trained up for a couple of weeks beforehand, so they know exactly how to play it. They're all playing exactly the same way. you come in, and the good person would say, "Well, madam, you know, just examine the back of your eyes, and we find this," and they explain in a very gentle way what it could be, and then she'll push and say, "Could it be a brain tumor?" And say, "Well, you know, it's one of the things we need to rule out. We're going to have an MRI straight away. We're going to look for it, and if it is," and that sort of empathetic approach. But there were some people who would just come in and go, "Oh, I think you've got a brain tumor," and the actors actors were so good, they would just burst into tears, like instantly, you know, floods of tears. And they would, the candidate would look at the two interviewers, we thought, "We're not even here, we're just watching, carry on." And that has always been the most discriminatory, you know, pathway or question. Maybe a simple thing like you're running late in the clinic and their parking's run out, they're going to get a parking ticket because you've been slow in the clinic and they're hacked off and you've got this cross patient. How are you going to deal with it? Apologize, diffuse. Somebody's had a complication. You've given somebody the wrong drops. They've had an allergic reaction to the eye drops. What are you going to do? It's just interpersonal skills, human skills. And it's really good way. It was some people brilliant academically, but you see them in that station, you go, "I don't want you in my clinic."
Right.
Because you can't, you can't talk to people. You don't have any warmth. You don't have any, you can't gauge what's happening in the room. And it's still the question that station, acting stations, are used to make a lot of the decisions. Because you almost take it as read. They're good academically. We can't test their surgical skills. We've tried that. We know it doesn't work. And you actually, this is a really great way of discriminating and predictive of who's going to be a, you know, a good doctor in your clinic.
So you can't, you don't think testing like a quick run on an IC would be a reasonable thing to do?
No, we didn't do that. When people sort of talked about, but of course, somebody may have had access to an IC before to practice, you know, so it doesn't work. And what we also tried to do, to your point you're making a few moments ago, is say, "Look, watch this video, you know, because a simple suturing, some six, you know, and we don't care if you've got a shake, whatever. We just want to see if you can follow these steps, tying a surgical, you know, can you actually just follow instructions?" So we're testing, can they listen to and follow some simple instructions? And, you know, that seemed to work, you know, okay, we thought, but then we saw it was really flat. Everybody was getting the same score. So no, we don't do any tests for manual dexterity. Because in ophthalmology, now, if you find that surgery is not for you, the medical ophthalmology route is very, you know, clearly mapped out for you. And many people choose to go down that, even if they're quite good at surgery, enjoy the surgery, many go down that route. But at least back in the day, there wasn't that option. And there are certainly many people who got through who probably shouldn't have, but they ended up in academic positions doing other things where they weren't operating. But in today's world, they would never have got through a surgical training program.
Right. I think all probably we've had that. Out of the 200 residents I've worked with, I mean, certainly there were a couple where they just kind of self-selected, like, you know, I'm going to do something non-surgical. Some did just research, and some did maybe medical retina only. And everyone finds their happiness.
Exactly. And many people are making the medical retina decision for positive reasons. They really love the immunology and the drugs and the, you know, the physicians, you know, side of things. For most people, it's a positive decision rather than, "Well, I can't do the surgery, so what am I going to do?" It's actually, "No, I've always really wanted to do this."
Makes a lot of sense. I think the future generation is going to be, they're going to be amazing surgeons. And hopefully one of them will make me pseudophagic, but I'm still thinking I want to stay minus two. I like the minus two.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I know you want to be minus two. You're going to have a really lovely monofocal,
right,
maybe slightly extended depth, folks, but you know, you was in minus two, very happy, glasses when I'm out walking the dog, but everything else, you know, looking at screens. Right. Yeah, they're always the hardest patients to please. But I said, good luck to the person who's doing your cataract today. They're going on a beta blocker the night before. Are you going to have both of them done at the same time, bilateral, simultaneous, sequential surgery?
Sure, why not? Because I'm not that picky on the lens counts. If it ends up anywhere between minus 1.5 and minus 2.5, I'll roll with it.
Yeah.
So it's all good.
It's a little way off, yeah, I would imagine.
What would you choose?
Well, I'm emmetropic. Yeah, I get a bit frustrated at the minute. We've got some of the putting in a lot of the Galaxy. Again, no financial interest in Rayner. I think really nice. Or EMV. Yeah, I don't mind wearing my little plus 1.5, you know, plus two readers. So maybe more sort of extended depth of focus, EMV distance, mid distance, and glasses for reading. Not fuss, but I've got two or three of my ex-trainees who are absolutely brilliant surgeons who are now well established in the corneal and cataract world. I'll line up to do it.
I'm holding out for a truly accommodating IOL. So hopefully by the time I'm ready, I'll get like 8 diopters of accommodation.
I think that's probably a way off yet, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But you know what? A man can hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, John, I can't believe we've been talking for more than an hour here. What a fantastic conversation. I've obviously a lot to learn from each other, especially from you. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to our whole audience here.
Udo, thank you so much for the opportunity to chat to you on the podcast. Since your first visit to the UK college meeting when I first met you and got to know you a little bit then, it's been a privilege just listening to your teaching, either in person or on the website. And I'll tell you a little anecdote to finish.
Sure.
I was watching one of your videos about 4 years ago about what to happen if you've got an Argentinian flag situation. And you say, okay, well, it's ripped round. You've tried everything to stop it, but so just making little horizontal linear cuts there.
Yeah.
So it's going to equalize the pressure. So it's not going to this way. It's got options of spreading. So the next day, there was a child that had a penetrating injury and gone through, fortunately, a very small injury in the cornea, damaged the lens, white cataract, milky cataract, got them to theater, vision blue. You saw it already had the Argentinian flag. I thought, I know what I'm going to do. You had your voice in my head just going, and the girls go, what are you doing? You're making it. I said, no. I'm going to make four little incisions like this. And by the end of the case, obviously very soft, it just sucks out. And a couple of them extended very slightly. It looked like one of my old tin opener capsule lobotomies from back in the day. Got a lens in the bag. And I wouldn't have known to do that without watching the video. So that child had benefited immensely, from, again, just watching that video. Fortuitous that it was literally the night before that it happened. And that to me was a really powerful lesson that actually there's lots of, you always learn, never too old to learn, pick up new tricks. But that was the most vivid example of how it directly changed what I would have done in a clinical situation. I would never have thought to have made those little slits in the capsule because I just hadn't seen it before. So thank you for that.
That's my pleasure. That's the beauty of the whole thing. We all learn together. Like I said, I learn way more than I contribute. So the amount of learning out there, it's just, and ophthalmologists in general, you and me specifically, we got a passion for learning. I always want to learn something new.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's not far before you're 3,000. So I'm going to look forward to seeing that. A big celebration. Now,
July of next year. I think it's July 24 next year.
Yeah, good stuff. Thank you so much for the invitation.
I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Catacoach podcast every Sunday, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, you find our Catacoach podcast. Plus, of course, got a new Catacoach video every single day. And also check out our sister channel, retinarounds.com, for retina videos, plus also a new retina podcast every Sunday. So until next time, I'll catch you later.